Welcome to the Switchblade Sisters Social Club, a true crime podcast where two sisters exploit their worst fears for your entertainment. You're welcome. I'm Dee.
And I'm Rhonda, and together we are the Sake Sisters. For more information, check out our website at www.switchbladesistersocialclub.com or find us on Instagram and Facebook at Switchblade Sisters Social Club.
Thanks for listening. Hi, my name's Dee, and this is Rhonda.
Hi.
We are Switchblade Sisters Social Club, a true crime podcast where two sisters exploit their worst fears for your entertainment. You're welcome and hello. Excited because I've had a hectic day, and so I'm really looking forward to just sitting back and listening to my favorite sister tell me a story. So just fucking tell me the story.
Okay, so I'm excited about this one too. And also, if anyone's watching, they will notice that it's light outside because we're recording. We record in the evenings, but because of the time change, it's light outside, which just feels really weird, doesn't it?
It does, but I love it.
I know, I love it too. But you know, when we record, I love that it's dark because it just adds to the ambient.
We will literally have the sunset on our recording.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so the other reason I'm excited, and it's kind of nice that it's light, is that today is a light and breezy topic. Because you know what? Nobody dies. And spoiler, it's got a happy ending.
What?
I know, but it is a crime.
Weird.
Yeah. Okay, so the backstory. Jamie, our podcast VA and my longtime friend, she was researching this episode, and she said, is it okay if I do something different? I was like, that's not murdery or you know. I was like, yes, I love those, you know. Okay, so this one combines catfishing and fraud and fake identities.
I do love a good catfish story. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy for a bit of light relief because the last few episodes have been super grim, haven't they?
Okay, this is a tale that couldn't have existed in any other time in history. So this would never have happened, let's say nowadays, when social media, everything's online. In the early 2000s, a young rap duo from California hit London, and they were tipped to be the next big thing in hip hop. And it's not a stretch to compare these guys to the Beastie Boys or Eminem. And after securing a record deal with Sony and appearing on MTV and supporting D12, they fell off the face of the earth. And it wasn't until a decade later that their story would be revealed. Their first show in London, they were spotted by someone called Chris Rock, not the Chris Rock the actor, but Chris Rock from Island Records, who directs them to management, and they end up being managed by Jonathan Shalit. If that name is familiar to you, it's because he's associated with artists like Elton John and Sting and N-Dubs. They were fucking awful.
The musical geniuses that are N-Dubs. Yeah.
Yeah. They did hit the big time for a period of time. And in April 2004, they sign a record deal with Sony for two singles and an album. And the pair work on recording material and continue to perform live, including opening for D12 at Brixton Academy and appearing on MTV. And things are starting to move really fast. However, Sony's merger and subsequent job losses left them without supporters in the record company. And their planned first single was delayed for at least 6 months as the label focused on other acts.
Wow, that would be fucking annoying, wouldn't it? You've got your dream record deal. You've got a contract.
Deanna, let me get to the good bit. This isn't even the good bit.
All right, I'm just saying. I'd be like, ugh.
That's because we can't wait. We can't wait. We're impatient. The best of times.
Yeah. Instant gratification, please. Instant and constant gratification. That's my method.
Yeah. Frustrating delays are commonplace in the industry, and this piled on the pressure to record something really good, because once they're in the spotlight, people are going to be talking about them, and some of those people are going to recognize them as a pair of kids from Scotland called Gavin and Billy.
What?
So they are not American rappers, let me tell you more.
Gavin
and Billy from Dundee.
I love it.
Not Silly Bill and Brains from California, but Gavin and Billy from Dundee. So they met in the late 90s, and they were studying at Dundee College. Their mutual love of hip-hop, skating, and making their own beats cemented their friendship, and neither of them held their studies in high regard because they wanted to be the next Eminem.
Wait, I need a visual. Give it to me.
Can you see? Yeah, that's them. Gavin, aka Brains, he said, I was just rapping and producing all the time, and so inevitably ended up getting chucked out of college. Our friend had showed us the thing happening in London where Polydor were looking for the next Eminem, so we thought, hell yeah, let's do this. So down we went. Now, the London audition. So they see an advert, and they get the megabus down to London. And not even 30 seconds into the audition, they were stopped by the judges. And the judges said to them that they sounded like the rapping Proclaimers.
Sorry, that's hilarious.
I know, it's quite funny. Laughed them out of the room, saying that they will never get anywhere rapping with Scottish accents.
Oh!
Yeah, and I watched the documentary. There's a really good documentary on this. You can see it on YouTube. Really good. But it was actually really sad to hear Gavin talk about this, because he said at that moment he thought his whole life was over. He's like, literally, somebody just shat on your dreams, you know? Like, the judges were harsh.
Can I just say, there's a TV show, I think on iPlayer, I cannot remember the name, but it's where they're trying to find new rappers in the UK. And once or twice, there's been Scottish rappers. And I think it sounds amazing.
Yeah. And do you know what else? Like, I think now we have an appreciation for accents in music.
Yeah. Because you remember a time where everyone had to lose their accent to sing or act.
I mean, first of all, like Oasis with their Mancunian accents.
Yeah.
Who else is there?
The Rap Game UK. That's the show. You would like it.
Okay. I'll watch it. I feel like now we actually appreciate accents. You know, it's funny. It's funny because a lot of this story would have been very different had it happened nowadays rather than, you know, almost 20 years ago. When you hear him talk about this in the documentary, it is really sad. But it has a happy ending with some ebbs and flows. So he said, it was quite traumatic for me when we got into the audition in the Covent Garden area of London and we rapped for 20 seconds and the label just started laughing. The main guy kind of stopped us and asked if it was a joke and who put us up to it.
Ouch!
We were just getting angrier and angrier. Of course, this wasn't a joke. This was our lives. Can you fucking imagine? The dickhead judge.
How rude.
Yeah, so their confidence was completely destroyed. And they said they felt like their life was over. And they wanted to prove people wrong and book shows in London, but no one was interested in Scottish rap. So they were trying to pick their spirits up a bit. And Billy made the next call using an American accent, saying, we're rappers from California. We're coming to London looking for a show while we're in town. And the response was more like, oh, wow, can you send us your music? And this was a bit of a wake-up call. And they realized maybe they just weren't marketable as they were being from, you know, a duo from Scotland. So they re-recorded their demo song using American accents and sent it into a BBC competition. And it makes it onto Radio One. And they won. First of all, they won the competition using American accents, the same song, but American accents. They won the competition, ended up on Radio 1 on heavy rotation, and they blew the fuck up.
That's crazy.
They realize if they're going to do this, they have to reinvent themselves. And they become fully immersed in these characters that they've created. And they are living them 24/7. So they pack up their new American identities and head to London. Gavin and Billy, who had created these personas, work on solidifying their backstory of growing up in San Jacinto, California. They even printed off maps of the area and learned street names and areas where they could have spent time to really, like, I guess it's like when you're in witness protection and you have a new identity and you have to, you're given a new
imagine they
life.
Bump into someone who knows the area. Maybe they shouldn't have picked LA where lots of people from the music industry will be familiar. But this is like, imagine the equivalent if we were like, oh, you know what? We want our podcast to do better. We need to pretend that we are, I was going to say that we're American. We do have slightly American accents, so it's not that big a stretch, but that we're like Indian. And so we need to do all of our shows with like an Indian accent. And then also when we're together, we need to pretend that we're Indian and get properly into our caricatures.
Well, this is it. Let me finish. They build caricatures as Silly Bill and Brains, which are like Jackass meets Beavis and Butthead. And they dressed as the perfect stereotype of American hip hop and skate culture that they'd, you know, learned from TV. And at the shows, Silly Bill and Brains were foul-mouthed, outrageous, and theatrical. And they rapped at crazy speeds, simultaneously jumping off stages, spraying fake blood over the crowds. And they became like a hip hop sort of Punch and Judy. Gavin said, we knew we had to have a story. So it was that weekend that we made up this manic, crazy story of two messed up dudes who had been taught how to rap by Eminem and traveled around America. So this story got wild that they'd been taught by Eminem. They became actors playing a role, but there was no downtime, no off switch, and they were in character 24/7, literally every minute of the day and every interaction, even with each other. When they're in talks about deals, like multiple record companies were interested, including Sony in the US, they have to sort of turn this down because they wouldn't be able to travel without exposing where they're from, because they don't have American passports. This is where it got tricky, you know, at the point where you have to show ID documents. That was kind of the flaw in their plan.
Imagine one of them sleep talks and people are like, dude, when you sleep talk, you've got a Scottish accent and you're sleep talking.
Well, yeah.
Oh my God, is that how they're exposed?
No. They have financial backing from the record company and housing. They get rehearsal space all covered, and they're starting to worry about the legal implications and what they would be if they're found out. Like, would they have to pay all the money back? Could they go to jail for fraud? There was no one to turn to who could even answer these questions. Now, I was thinking, is it fraud? Yeah. But is it fraud in the legal sense? I mean, I guess so, because they've signed contracts, but then is it fraud? They would have put their real names down on contracts, right? Do you have to put your nationality down on a work contract? James Bourne of Busted said of them that he thought they were going to be absolutely massive. And Mary, who is Billy's long-term girlfriend, so silly Bill, describes visiting him in London as mortifying, seeing him speaking with an American accent. And Billy recalls being at a backstage bar at the Brit Awards and someone saying, oh, you're from California. I thought you were Scottish. And he's been drinking. Do you remember you said that, you know, what happens if they're talking in a Scottish accent in their sleep? So he's been drinking and he's questioning whether he's been talking in a Scottish accent when he's drunk. This really shakes him up. And on this occasion, he's alone, but the boys are used to watching each other's backs in conversations, ready to pick up and divert when needed. And like, can you imagine being the heightened stress of constantly like...
Oh, it would be awful.
Yeah.
And that poor girlfriend, because can you imagine going to see your partner and being like, ugh, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah. Well, you know, they're doing pretty good financially at this
point. Yeah, I know, but it would still be cringe, wouldn't it?
Cringy, yeah. You know, I can imagine, well, I can't really imagine, but I can imagine that they would have felt highly stressed of watching their back all the time waiting to be found out, because when you've got this success, but all the success is built on
a lie, a massive lie. Yeah.
But then at the same time, they were talented. But anyway, we'll talk more about that. So some of these situations were trickier than others. And in an interview with Jonathan Shalit, you know, the manager, this is what Gavin said. After he agreed to take them on, we said, well, the thing is, Jonathan, we have no money. We need someone in front of us, or we need to go back to America. He asked us how much we need. And I said, well, we don't get out of bed for less than 70 grand. I don't know why I said it. It was just this false confidence. And I thought he would come back and say, I'll give you 10 grand. And I would have been sold. And then Gavin says he left the room and Billy went mental at me saying, why did you say that, you idiot? We have no money. However, he came back and he agreed we had 35 grand each. They're booked for a last minute support slot for D12 at Brixton Academy, which is a big venue in London.
An amazing venue.
And likely because they had pretended to be friends with D12. And there's a real danger that it's all over. One of the guys from D12 says, who the fuck are these guys? And what actually happens is that Silly Bill and Brains, they confidently approach Proof from D12 and exchange hellos, high fives, and handshakes. And that's pretty much it. And Gavin added, when we got to the venue, D12 were on stage sound checking. And so we decided we just had to be confident. And we went on the stage and gave the group all a hug and a handshake as if we'd known them for years and no questions were asked.
Yeah, because that awkward moment where you're like, shit, do I know this person? Just pretend.
But you know, it is funny how much you can fake it to make it.
Yeah.
The conviction, if you've got conviction and good acting skills, the things you can convince people of. Like, I remember having this manager when I was teaching. He was the head of faculty. Nice guy, but someone so out of his depth. I tried to set him up with you once, remember?
Yes.
Just, you know, when you're like, how did this person get promoted? You know, they struggle to know what day of the week it is. Because he was posh and looks convincing in a suit, he got further than he probably should have.
Well, people get promoted to their level of incompetence.
Yes.
I was just Googling. Do you remember there was that meddler guy who faked a career as well?
No.
Jared Threatening Eames.
Oh.
He like paid to have these music videos made, paid to have these concerts so that it looked like he was like this making it big, and based his whole career on that. He faked it till he made it and then got exposed. But by that point, he had like a whole tour booked and all sorts.
It reminds me of one of the Real Housewives called Erica Jane, where she's had a career fully funded by her soon-to-be ex-husband, who's there's a scandal around him because he stole millions from his clients. But yeah, it's crazy. You can buy yourself a career. Which is when you buy yourself a career, aren't you making losses? But anyway, whatever. So they're interviewed on MTV and they're really concerned about the fallout from being seen on TV, if anyone recognizes them, because they're worried that someone from their hometown, from their childhood, you know, old school friends, someone was going to say something or post something online. So yeah, this was at a time when MySpace was around, but like, you know, Instagram, whatever, wasn't big yet. So the plan is to make a number one record and then come out on the Jonathan Ross show or something like that and, you know, come out as heroes. They were planning themselves on exposing their lie and hoping that there was some sort of good PR twist in that. And the idea is that if they're seen as extraordinary artists, it's pretty funny. But the flip side of that is that they're exposed and then they're in big trouble because they didn't know where they stood with the law at this point. So the lawyer, this is what Gavin said, the lawyer always knew that something was up and that we would have to lie to him constantly about why we didn't have our American passports. And he was always suspicious of us. We eventually got signed by Sony UK. And the day we were signing, our lawyer didn't want it to happen as we could have been anyone. We didn't have any identification, but everyone was sort of like, shut up, Tim, lawyer's name, as they loved us so much. So we managed to get the deal signed.
I mean, no background check at all.
I mean, you know, part of me thinks, for what?
Criminal record?
Yeah, but still, I mean, there's a lot of musicians with criminal backgrounds.
I know, but like, you know, there's, let's say, acceptable crimes in the music industry.
Yeah.
And then there's like, oh my God.
R. Kelly. By this time, though, this is what Gavin says, our lawyer, who was already suspicious, was seeing stuff online with people saying, oh, I battered Gav in a chip shop, or hey, I went to school with Billy, what are they doing? The duo were set to appear on MTV, and Gavin admits that they would use distraction techniques to prevent them from having to answer too many tough questions.
What were their distraction techniques?
I'm going to tell you. We would just start jumping over couches, beating each other up, anything to distract from having to answer things in too much detail so people wouldn't suspect us, but also it would entertain them.
I am going to do that in my next Zoom meeting when someone asks me a question I don't know the answer to. I'm just going to jump up and down on the couch. I'm going to do Tom Cruise.
But living a lie took a toll, and Gavin especially starts overthinking and getting very anxious about all this, which is understandable considering what happens after that, you know, is unpredictable at best and catastrophic at worst if they're exposed. So in truth, they miss the window to get their music out, and changes at Sony, including a merger and thousands of job losses, push things back and back. And realistically, they could have gone with the first version of what they had. And the relationship between Gavin and Billy is at breaking point. And they're starting to have a lot of fights at this point. And Mary, who's Billy's girlfriend, is now pregnant, and Billy decides he has to leave. So the plan was to, quote unquote, make it, get rich and famous, and give his family a great life. So he heads back to Scotland, and Gavin is now alone and in London, and he's treading water and losing grip on industry relationships with people who were interested in them only as a duo. Gavin feels completely betrayed, isolated, and at breaking point, and his sister finds him after an overdose, after a suicide attempt. He's struggling, he's self-medicating, he's determined to see this through, though, and he's going to accomplish what he set out. So Billy is now settled into family life in Scotland, but Gavin is about to go on stage again for the first time in a while, and he sees this kind of as a return of the Brains McLeod character, but he can't get his head straight, and he feels like he doesn't know who he is anymore. And when he gets on the stage, he says, my name is Gavin, and I'm not American, I'm Scottish, and I've never been to America.
They've never even been.
No. So Gavin racked up tens of thousands of pounds worth of debt as well. And he resorted to working as an escort, where he wined and dined rich older ladies for money and going to blood and sperm banks to raise any cash he could to settle his debts. He would finally reveal the hoax much later at a fundraising gig in aid of his friend Ivan, who had been diagnosed with cancer. And Gavin said, before I was about to go on and perform at this gig, my friend received a message to say Ivan had died. My friend just said to me, it was time to drop all this and go on and just be myself. So I went to the microphone and just started talking in a Scottish accent and told them, this is the real me. I think I shocked over 300 people that night. And there were friends that I had made over the previous 5 years who didn't even know the truth until then. Most of them thought it was pretty cool, and I still have those friendships to this day. So they didn't hold it against them. The very next day, I woke up and began writing my book, California Scheming. And it's not a great name.
Great name. Great name.
The whole second career started. Mm-hmm. Billy and Gavin reunited in 2013 to release their album, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, with Gavin still writing and producing music under the name Brains McLeod to this day. He is also currently working on a film script to tell their story of the greatest ever hip-hop hoax. I like this story a lot because it has a happy ending. They reunited. Yeah. You know, it has a really sad part of the story where he attempts suicide.
It's not surprising if you have to pretend so much to be someone totally different that you lose yourself. And if you've got so much of your aims and your dreams and everything dependent on not being busted.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So much pressure that everything hinges on that. And also, I looked into this, the psychology of method acting. And acting is far more than just pretending to be someone else. It's a complex process that requires someone to fully embody another character, including their personality, emotions, motivations, and mannerisms. And in a 2019 study published by the Royal Society Open Science, examined the brain regions that are activated when method actors adopt a fictional first-person perspective during dramatic role-play. The authors asked the participants, who were in an MRI scanner, to respond to a series of hypothetical questions of themselves and also their assigned characters. And they found that the actor's brain activity in the areas involved in self-processing was reduced when responding in character rather than responding as themselves. And the authors interpreted this observed brain changes as a suppression of self. And this suggests that acting, to an extent, is a suppression of self-processing. So they maybe weren't aware of all of that, but the psychological impact of effectively leading a double life.
Well, leading a single life, but one that's not your own.
Yeah.
It's going to affect your mental health, as it obviously did.
Yeah, and the thing is, the most important thing in life is family and friends, and then is work. And if your work, you know, which pays for you to exist, all hinges on, you know, whether or not people find out that lie. I can imagine it's kind of, but to a lesser extent, like you've committed a crime and you have to constantly look over your shoulder.
Yeah.
But you know what? I do like this story because I think it's, you know, it's fraud, first of all. And I do something fascinating.
But
about
you can
fraud.
See why they would do it.
Completely.
And you feel for them that they even had to think of it as an option.
Yeah. So if you think about the backstory, it never would have happened had they not been laughed out of that competition. Never would have happened.
Yeah.
Secondly, it is a victimless crime.
Yeah. And thirdly, like with Belle Gibson, do you remember the influencer? Mm-hmm. I mean, that was totally different. That was evil.
Yeah.
But it's the responsibility of these promoters, like with Belle Gibson, she had a book deal. She was working with Apple. Where is their due diligence?
Yeah. And eventually it was the lawyer that found out. And I would highly recommend watching the documentary.
I'm going to read California Scheming.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do you know what? Jamie, in another interesting fact, Jamie, who alerted me to this case and who did a lot of the research for it, she actually knew them. Did I mention that?
No.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So this is how she was aware of it, because she knew them, but she knew them originally as their American selves, because this was in London. This was at the time when, you know, Jamie's very involved in the music scene. And so she knew them as their American selves. And then she remembered, again, meeting them later on, you know, with their Scottish accents.
Oh, we're Scottish now.
She said the book is really well written.
Okay, interesting.
Really well written, yeah. So, and I can believe that, because actually he's, you know, interesting to listen to when you listen. And the music was good.
Yeah, if they're amazing rappers, you know they're going to be great with their words. And it sounds like they were super clever to be able to pull this off as long as they did. They
yeah,
got the smarts.
And I'm really wondering, like, really, actually, what there was clearly no moral crime here. I'm really wondering where the badness is, because to be honest, they weren't lying about their talent. They weren't lying about that. Their music was good. You know, it was good. They were good performers. When you hear some stories about the music industry in Hollywood and some of the shows.
Yeah, this feels like the least.
This is like a Disney crime.
That's it. Disney crime.
Yeah,
yes.
Like, this is a harmless crime, which is a great story. I really hope that this film really comes out.
Get in touch if you can think of a genuine negative. I mean, I'm thinking maybe there are some fans that might be hurt by the deception, but I don't know enough about their music. Are they singing about growing up on the streets of LA?
We wouldn't have been upset. Let's say, you know, we were listening to them back in the day. I wouldn't have felt deceived.
Do you know what? Some people, it's a pride thing. Will they feel stupid for believing?
I was annoyed that Morrissey is a fucking racist or right wing at the very least, because I love the Smiths' music. That annoys me. But if he turns out not to be from Manchester and to be from Coventry instead, that's not going to bother me. I mean, if he's not a vegetarian, you know, that's a lie. That's not going to bother me.
I feel like once you hear the full story, you wouldn't judge them for it.
No. And, I think it's a great fucking story.
Amazing.
Everything from that first audition, rapping in Scottish to... I feel like it's gone, you know, a full circle that they're back together.
The only kind of victim, I suppose, is like the record labels and the music executives. But I find it really hard to feel sorry for them, you know?
Yeah, but also, don't you feel like sometimes a story like this makes records sell more?
Yeah.
Like when there's a scandal, then, you know, people go to buy that person's book or people go to buy those records. People go to watch it on TV. It's like, you know, remember the Amber Heard and Johnny Depp case?
No such thing as bad publicity.
Yes, exactly. And I remember like rewatching lots of Johnny Depp films at the time, just because at that time when the court case was happening, just because it reminded me, there was that film and that film. So I actually think the record company probably didn't suffer at all from this.
Yeah.
I think the only person annoyed in this whole story is the lawyer.
Yeah. Why aren't people listening to me? Why hire me for my professional opinion and ignore me?
Yeah, but I love it because we love the underdogs, don't we?
Oh, I'm going to check them out.
Yeah.
We'll post links to their Spotify.
Yeah. And there's a short 10-minute version of the documentary on YouTube as well. So, you know, if you just want to have a short bit of background, but yeah, I'm perfectly likable guys, you know?
Yeah, I like that story.
I like it too. And I hope our listeners do because, you know, technically there's some sort of crime there.
I think our listeners like when we mix it up. So a couple of grim episodes and then a lighter one to like lighten the mood for a bit.
Yeah.
But, you know, it feels weird transitioning to the People's Pulse because I don't feel like I need it for my mental health today.
No, I know. Don't you feel good after this story?
Yeah. But we're still going to do People's Pulse.
Yeah. But I'm happy for them. And I want to read that book. So,
yeah.
People's Pulse. So our question of the week was this. Favorite childhood toy. Now, the reason we ask this is because every time we ask about your favorite 90s film, favorite 90s band, you guys...
deliver.
Yeah, you guys deliver.
But we didn't want to do 90s toy because we thought some of you were not children in the 90s.
Some of you may not have even been born. And I'm talking to Mia.
Mia. So we've gone for just favorite childhood toy. Can I start off with some of mine?
Yes.
All right. So most of my favorite ones that I thought of were the ones that we weren't allowed in our household.
Oh, why? Because I can only remember one thing we didn't have that we desperately wanted.
Nintendo.
Oh, that's the one. That's the fucking one. Why didn't we have that? Everyone had one. Okay, but, you know, we didn't have a deprived upbringing. We did have an
Atari. No, don't feel bad for us. But our parents were not keen on getting involved in the games console thing because they were like, well, you have to buy the console and then you have to buy all the games. And it was at a time where they didn't have the same secondhand game market that they do now. And so they were like, nope, just not getting involved in that cycle of consumerism. Fucking hippies. Yeah, just loved going around to friends' houses and playing Super Mario.
Yeah, it was a great era for computer games, wasn't it? This was after the Commodore 64, is it? That was not our era. I actually have one of those at home because that's part of Jim's era. So I've got an old Commodore. Is it 64? Is that what it's called? This big old retro
thing. Yeah, I mean, it was a Commodore, yeah.
Yeah, so...
I've got one too. Okay. I also have, for those who don't know this... I have an arcade machine, which I rigged up so that I can change the games in it. So I have Pac-Man, Donkey Kong... 1942 and 43.
That machine was a key feature of all your great parties when we lived in a flat. Mm-hmm. So I also have something else to add. Side note, just looking at the messages. Guess who I'm now friends with?
Oh my God.
Susie's mom.
No way.
I'm Susie's sister. You know our merch drop and we have Susie's sister's quote. So Susie's sister, hopefully she loved that. And she commented on the post. And then somehow Susie's mother started following us. I was like, I'm going to get in her DMs. And I can confirm. Just as fucking funny as Susie.
Okay, this is what I want you to do. I want you to ask Susie and was it Helen?
Mm-hmm. Sister Helen.
Ask them for their funniest mom quotes.
Okay.
I'm foreseeing some more merch.
You know what? You can absolutely tell that Susie's mom is an absolute legend and absolutely hilarious.
Oh, I'm sure she's got some one-liners and some life mantras.
Yeah.
I want Susie's mom's word of advice.
Yes.
Because I suspect it will make great merch.
Susie, you heard it here. DM us. Okay, so favorite toy. So Susie is our first. And oh, this is going to bring back memories. My favorite 80s toy was my Care Bear. I had the Cheer Bear, which was the pink one with a rainbow on its belly. The Care Bear came everywhere with me. Even now, it's tucked up in bed in my old bedroom at mom's. Oh, Care Bears. We love them so much. We each had a Care Bear.
We do, and I still have mine. I have I'm just Googling because I can't remember the name, but the purple raccoon Care Bear.
And I had the blue one, which is still in my house somewhere, with like heart-shaped raindrops on the stomach. Oh, fucking love a Care Bear.
The raccoon is called Brightheart, and the blue Care Bear is Grumpy.
Yeah. That's what I thought his name was. My God. Do you know what? I know we say they don't make films like they used to. They don't make music like they used to. But they also don't make toys like they used to. Because that's just reminded me of, do you remember Popples?
Popples. I still have my Popple too.
Fucking love the Popples. And you know the other one? Glowworms.
Glowworms? Yeah.
Oh, what the fuck kind of toxic shit was in that? To make it glow.
Things should not be that fluorescent and given to children who put things in their mouths. Because our mom was not super keen on Barbie. Because you remember 80s, 90s Barbie?
We didn't like Barbie, huh?
Yeah, but we didn't like him very much. But it was also because we weren't... our mom had a very strong opinion on Barbies. And of the time, it was like... I know now we have all those lawyer and doctor Barbies. But the 80s, 90s Barbies were super misogynist. I mean, she was literally a different shape, you know?
Yeah.
So we were never encouraged to go down that road. So we had My Little Pony. And Glowworms.
Yeah, so much.
Polly Pocket.
Oh, Polly Pocket. Oh my God. Okay, and there's this other one, and I cannot remember when I describe it. Our listeners will be like, yeah. I know that one. Okay, so basically it was this. It was like this big, less than the size of your fist. And then it was like when you open it up, it's a plastic doll. When you fold it, it's like a plastic circle with a gem on top. And now I know that our listeners know exactly what the fuck I'm talking about. And it pops up a lot on Instagram and Facebook in like the 80s nostalgia accounts. But it was like, you open it up and it's a doll, then you fold it up and it's like a circle with a gem. I don't know what the fuck you're supposed to do with it, but that's what it was. And I loved it.
I mean, just open and close it, surely. I'm Googling and I can't find it. So please, because it's just coming up with fold open doll houses.
How do you even Google that?
I don't know. Someone tell us what that was.
Oh, Keepers. Keepers, K-E-Y-P-E-R-S, Keepers. I had like a swan that you put a key in it and it opens it up.
Mm-hmm. Other games that my friends had that I loved, Dream Phone.
Oh my God, I was just going to say that's one we didn't have, Dream Phone.
Yeah, Game of Life.
Don't remember that, but I don't remember that. I fucking have that at home. Chay plays that all the time.
Yeah. So yeah, there's a bunch.
Oh, Fashion Wheel.
Oh, Fashion Wheel.
Fashion Wheel. What a fucking great toy. Does that still exist? That's a great toy.
Can I just say that one that I never wanted and I didn't understand why it was a thing, and it sounds like just a toy that is a patriarchal trick to make girls grow up to want to be mothers.
Oh, God.
Lucy Liu.
I don't remember that.
A doll that literally just, the thing it does is go to the toilet.
Oh, like Baby Annabelle and stuff like that. Yeah, I don't understand stuff like that. Okay, so another one. Don't know what we used to call this, but Lisa, Sparkly Fairy Lisa, says she loved the Lemon Twist toy. And she said that's her favorite toy ever and seriously would rock that for literal hours every fucking day. Now, we didn't call it, ours didn't have a lemon on it, but I'm going to show you this video and I don't remember what it was called. But basically, it was like, imagine a loop that you put on your leg. And then,
yeah.
What, I'm trying to explain what you do with it. A loop you put on your leg like a lasso.
Do you know what it's like? A manacle? Is that the right?
No, I don't know. No. I've never heard that word. It's a lasso you put on your leg and then you kind of hop around it and you make it spin. Can you describe it any better than that?
No, well, no, because I just invented a word.
Manacle. Monocle?
No. Ball and chain. Yeah, manacle is a thing.
Okay.
A ball and chain. It's like a ball and chain.
Yeah.
But it's made out of lightweight plastic and you kind of spin it around and hop over. Yeah, whatever. Google it, guys.
Like a hula hoop for the leg.
Yeah. Lisa, Sparkly Fairy Lisa, are you going back to Harrogate this year? If so, I'll see you there.
Then, Coventry Karen says, my fave toy as a child has to be My Little Pony stable. I don't know where my folks got it from. I suspect it was the last in the shop, slightly faulty, and possibly they got a few quid knocked off as the roof hinge was broken. I found it in my garage a few years ago and gave it and my ponies to my friend's granddaughter. I had a baby Applejack, which was my fave one. I used to love braiding their hair and racing them. Oh, that's so cute that you still had it and passed it on. Isn't that
nice? That's so cute. We didn't have a home for our My Little Ponies.
No, I don't remember that. But Karen says, one of your future PPs should be, what was the toy you always wanted as a child and never got? Oh,
well, we just said.
Because we're sulky bitches still.
Yeah, they are also our favorite toys, probably because we've never had them. And because we always want what we can't have.
So then, oh, fave Sam. Yeah. Ooh, he sent a picture of something I've never seen before. He says, I love my Coca-Cola spinner yo-yo. I could do rock the cradle around the world and walk the dog. Luckily, I'm too mature to waste my spare time on such now. There is a video attached to this submission.
Oh my God, is it him?
It is. And we're gonna, with permission, post it on our socials.
Oh my God, is this him doing it?
Yes, motherfucker. Aww.
Oh, bless him, Sam. That's adorable.
That's going to go viral. We're going to stick that on our socials and that's going to go viral. Look at that yo-yo action. Yes. Oh, I want to try that. So that's what you're supposed to do with the yo-yo.
All right. This is an audio format. So let's crack on.
I could watch that 3-second clip for hours.
I know. Send it to me. I want to watch it.
I like it. Then, okay, you sent something on behalf of Vicky. She says, this is my favorite childhood toy, my Take That Robbie doll. I used to pretend he was real and do pretend weddings, just practice for the day it really happened. Then he left the band in November 95 and I threw it out the window and tore him out of all my posters. He was the first boy to break my heart. Oh, you know what? I remember what a big deal it was when he left Take That.
They set up a helpline.
It's so funny because we just were not into Take That. We were aware, but just not into them. But I remember it was like Beatlemania. Not that I remember Beatlemania, but it was like mass hysteria. Take That, around Take That.
I gotta say, my friend Vicky's fucking hilarious because she loves her punk music, knows all of the bands up and down the country, travels around the country to go see these punk bands, and is also fucking obsessed with Take That. And I just love, I just love those two things about her in unison. I also, speaking of punk, have, not calling him a punk, but I've got a submission from Barnaby from Sonic Boom 6.
Oh, yeah.
Who told me that his favorite toy is a Spider-Man doll that he used to call Pider-Man.
Why?
Well, I was like, why? Did he like pies? Did you like pies? I realized, oh, because you were a child who couldn't speak properly.
Oh.
Pider-Man.
Oh.
Thanks, Poppy.
Oh, got a message from Joanne. She said, we listened to The Crow whilst out here in the desert in Joshua Tree. We both loved the episode, although Kev, who's older than Methuselah's balls, thinks he knew most of it. And she said, fabulous show. Ah, oh, Joanne. Oh,
And we had a lovely message as well, didn't we, from Lindsay?
Lindsay, oh.
Who said that it inspired her to watch The Crow again.
Oh. So Joanne also says, her and her sister had, and her sister still has, this plastic doll with a string that you pull from her head, and she says various phrases in a bonkers American voice that sounds like Dan Aykroyd doing Julia Child. And over the years, while still working, don't know how really, there's one phrase that comes up so rarely that when we pull the string, we're always on tenterhooks. Here comes my body. That's what it says. I'm hoping this her sister will pick up this message, dig out said doll and pull the string again while filming it and then post this. It must be at least 50 years old now.
Old Here comes my body?
Yeah.
I love that. Oh my God, that might be new merch. Here comes my body.
Here comes my body. You know what? After this episode, after we finish recording, I'm going to remember so many other toys and be like, fuck, I should have mentioned that. Fuck, I should have mentioned that. But I have mentioned the highlights, the glowworms, the popples, the Polly Pockets. Oh.
Yeah.
Care Bears. Is there anything else? Oh, Teddy Ruxpin.
Hey, Rexman. I also just want to give a shout out to our mom because she was adorable and she used to like make us Play-Doh from scratch and stuff like that. So we had a lot of crafting in our household.
We can't fault her.
I mean, we can and we have done on this pod rather publicly, but life was never boring.
No, and I hope to God that no one ever has presuppositions of what our mother is like based on what we are like, because our mother is just perfection. She's not foul-mouthed. She's elegant. She's classy.
She loves a salad and a water.
She's tactful, you know, most of the time. I mean, she's fucking chaos, but I hope to God that no one thinks we have like a trashy mother like us, because no. That would be easy to assume, but no.
It is literally a family mystery how we turned out the way we are.
Yeah. But that being said, do you remember we had an embargo put on us by our dads to never talk about him again on the podcast after we said he takes the free shampoo from hotels?
Mm-hmm.
We then said...
Oh, and wait, and also the other thing we're not allowed to mention is that he also rinses out the airline for their small bottles of wine. But yes.
Oh, yeah, that too. Yeah.
And other things that we're not allowed to talk about.
Earphones and socks.
Oh, wait, and then also he probably doesn't want us to talk about that time when we're in Rome and I got a shot of vodka and I really liked the glass. So he put it in his pocket and took it for me.
Yeah.
Probably doesn't want us to mention that either.
Oh, but you know what? When I told him, because he does ask us about the podcast occasionally, when I told him that our dear friend Karen in the States said that she likes the stories about him, he was like, oh, I was like, does that mean the embargo is lifted?
And is it?
I can't remember because you know what, Dee, we're going to talk about it anyway. So that was that. Did you love it?
I absolutely loved all of those responses. Everyone, thank you so much for your People's Pulse responses. I just want to say again, do I want to say this? Yeah, if you're listening to this podcast, as soon as it comes out, you will still have time to buy tickets for my event this evening at the Brewery Market, St. George's Day event. So we're going to be talking about homegrown horrors, English serial killers, and craft beers. So really excited about that. I have a special outfit planned. I will post pictures, but I'll send them to you to post, obviously. Now I have to go because I need to go car shopping because of the drunk driver that hit my car. And now it has officially been written off.
But you know what else we're going to go do? Watch Married at First Sight.
Oh, we are going to watch Married at First Sight Australia. Yeah. I mean, I'm going to do that while car shopping.
I hope everyone's in a good mood after this episode because nobody died. No one got hurt.
I am in a good mood. Are you in a good mood?
Of course I fucking am. I love the feel-good ones. This might be our first ever one.
We've had a few others. So we've had others that have been like funny enough. I don't know. I think next week mine is quite grim. So
I tell you who we do have coming on. Stephen Keough.
Yeah. And you know what else I'm working on?
What?
I'm really excited about this. Should we announce this? Yeah, I'm gonna. So, we love The Staircase, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
On Netflix. Mm-hmm. Oh, fuck, have I not even told you?
No. Oh, no, I do know this. Oh, my God. Oh, my fucking God. I thought you were gonna bring the guy on.
No, not now. So, basically, we love The Staircase. Amazing documentary. And then slightly more mediocre dramatization, although I do love Toni Collette in everything and everything she does. So The Staircase, just in summary, was a guy who got done for killing his wife, pushing her down the stairs. It also emerged that someone else in his life, in a previous life of his, had also died in very similar circumstances. But there was basically a little theory that it might have been an owl.
I know, this is the craziest shit ever.
I got approached by a man who has written a book on the owl theory. So it's a man called Titty Smith. And he approached me and said he liked the podcast, blah, blah, blah. So we've been talking and I've been reading his book. It's amazing. I'll talk about it more. But basically, we're going to be interviewing him about the owl theory.
Our fave Sam has to explain the owl theory to me. And it's interesting.
Well, I have so many thoughts on it, which I'm going to share in the episode.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert. At the time, I thought it was kind of bonkers. And now I totally think it was the fucking owl. And that there was a conspiracy to protect the owl.
Uh-oh, for fuck's sake. Don't say anymore.
All right. If you want to know how I've come to that conclusion, you're going to have to check out that bonus episode. But yeah, we've got some amazing stuff lined up. I'm really excited about all of it and everything all the time. Okay. So on that note, I'm going to go car shopping. You're going to go and watch TV. And we're going to think about how sexy our listeners are.
Mwah!
And how much we love them. So goodbye, sexy listeners.
Love
Bye.
You. Bye.
Hey there. Thanks for being a loyal listener.
Do you need a new website or want to boost your social media performance? Or do you hate podcast editing? You've tried optimizing your website and social media channels, but you're still not getting the listeners, downloads, and engagement you want?
We, the Safi Sisters, love helping people with tasks that they hate. We know a thing or two about podcasts, websites, and social media, and we love working with other podcasters and business owners.
So why not head over to SwitchbladeSistersSocialClub.com and go to our Work With Us section. We believe in collaboration over competition. A rising tide raises all ships.
Bye!